Ray, why are we here today?
Wait a minute. This is a reversal. This is making me uncomfortable. Why are we here? Well, we're here today to continue a conversation that we're having with Lerna Ekman-Chola. If you missed it, you know, the first half of our conversation was a historical discussion of the experience of Turkish Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, with some brief discussion of dynamics in the post-Ottoman Empire.
Yep, it's a great lead-in. I think you can listen to this episode on its own. Highly recommend you go back and to listen to part A. But here in part B, we're going to have just unique perspective, unique set of insights that Lerna has to offer us, given her background and her identity and scholarship that she can offer on the Arab-Israel or Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and then how it impacts on our college campuses, MIT in particular.
Yeah, I think she's going to do something that, you know, academics rarely do. I mean, we're comfortable being analytical about a situation, you know, observe, not experience. Mm. But Lerna's going to do something a little different, right? She's going to bring her whole self, and through herself, provide deep insights and see our challenges through her personal experiences and share those personal experiences with us. So let's get started. Lerna, what you've been sharing helps us to understand why, when we were talking about the challenges that we were having on the campus in the fall, and how you mentioned how you were able to identify with both Jews and Palestinians.
Yes.
I mean, this kind of gives us some insight into that answer.
Yeah, you're in a unique position, I think, mm-hmm. right? To do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was it ever difficult, is what I would ask you. Were you ever forced to choose?
Always, unfortunately. But I always refuse to be reduced to that framework of choice. It's irrelevant for me. Like, I speak about this with my family, maybe very close friends, but it's not as rehearsed as the previous. Because the previous, whatever we talked, is also part of my research
or what I teach.
Right. Okay. So I'm trying to think how I can find a way of not starting with historical. Yeah.
Like, maybe just talk us through what you were seeing or hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, previously when we first started talking about these issues, I do remember saying that I suffer from over-identification. Mm. I think suffering, which is already a loaded term in this context, is what I felt then in the fall and later on, and suffering because of over-identification in different ways.
So maybe the transition is a little bit into your research first, where, you know, you've written this, I think it's a great article, where you talk about how you identify with African-Americans during the Black Lives Matter movement, how you identify with Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, because I think what you're calling over-identification, I keep thinking of the habit of mind position that you've taken.
But it is different. I just recognized it, really, right now. I don't identify with African Americans or indigenous people, not at all. I do go into this parallel universe in which I did develop this habit of mind of imagining how my own country would have looked like or responded to the world if it treated its own minorities or indigenous people, its own others, really, in similar ways. But okay, I think I want to start from my last name again. My migration. So I left Turkey at some point, right? In 2002, after I graduated from Boğaziçi University's sociology department, or qualitative sociology there, I came to the United States to do my PhD. I don't have anyone in America, like, even though many Armenians have ties, diasporic ties here, by coincidence, my people are not here. So I'm on my own. And for the first time, I am not a minority somewhere. It was very interesting, this whole experience of, also, I look white. All of a sudden, I became, like, technically looking like a majority, really. Like, if I don't speak, no one would understand that I wasn't belonging to the main group. But then when you speak, totally, it's different. But still, it was, I also went to New York City. Very welcoming. I had beautiful graduate student years over there. My difference, audible difference, there were so many, there people understood me. I had more difficulty with understanding other people's accents than I got used to them.
When you say the minority, Ray, it reminds me of our colleague Kat Turco's work in that what it means to be a minority, I think what here you're saying is it's not simply that you're in a part of a group that is, say, small or lacking in power, but it has some kind of salience in the larger culture as being other or being, you know, a threat or being marginalized in some way. Whereas in America, Armenianness doesn't have that cultural salience, right, in the same way.
And on top of it, the fact that Armenianness is such an irrelevant identity here was so liberating. I was like, no one cares. Like, I'm from Turkey, good. I'm Armenian, good. It doesn't cure the burden.
Right.
Like, I was unburdened in the United States, which I think is the reason why I stayed.
Wow. This goes back to what we've been using as this metaphor of the fish being able to see the water because they're an outsider to another someone. But in this case, you're an outsider sort of to yourself back in Turkey, right? Where you get put into another place. And good news is you can live in this water and you can see yourself more clearly through an American lens, right?
Yes, while at the same time never being able to feel or identify as majority, but at least because I'm irrelevant, people are indifferent to me, which is as good as it gets for me because I'm not aspiring to be white at all. But then there are, I increasingly understand the more intricate ways of how groups that are considered minority here are treated, at least not legally, but in other ways, police violence, indigenous movement, all that. And then I became a citizen and I had the right. It's the best time to change your last name, right? Like even after this awakening, I still insisted that I'm going to keep my Turkish last name, which caused a lot of problems amongst my people in the United States because I increasingly became part of American Armenian diaspora, as well as Turkish diaspora, by the way. So I really occupy both spaces that don't intersect, actually, very often. So why did I not change my Turkish last name? Many Armenians resent this because we do have IAN last names.
Right.
It is, and also we know that Turks forcibly did this to us, the last name. So am I endorsing my master's choices, basically? Or is
right.
it time for me to reclaim my own possibly previous or brand new identity last name? I kept the master's, basically. To pay tribute to the people who, despite all the difficulties, assimilationist policies, discrimination, they maintain their Armenianness. They passed it to me. It is relevant to me and it's valuable to
wow.
me that I'm trying to pass to my kids.
So, you know, your refusal to be reduced, you already have, this is already evidence for that. You refuse to be reduced
right.
to your last name. Can I make an observation?
Yes.
And it's... Mm-hmm. So I think you're the perfect example of this outsider-insider relationship that we've been emphasizing during our time together. And as you were just talking, you know, in a sense, I'll use the word privileged. You can put that in air quotations if you like. You weren't actively excluded. And
mm-hmm.
so that allowed
sure.
you to have at least gained some insight into multiple groups in the U.S., that maybe for someone whose identity is salient, they wouldn't be in the same position. And
Totally.
I think, by the way, that's a lot
exactly.
of the Jewish experience in the United States as well. Like, I don't think many Jews wanted to basically
mm-hmm.
become
mm-hmm.
white. What American Jews kind of embraced was in most public spaces anyway, at least after a certain amount of time anyway, the ability to be unmarked,
mm-hmm.
like you're saying. Right. And then
mm-hmm.
I think that's some
exactly.
of the shock after
yes.
October 7th is to all of a sudden feel like,
right exactly.
Right, to have that
you are
identity
back
being marked
again.
Right.
We also talked about how many of our Jewish community, it wasn't that they were just marked. is they want it to be Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that they wanted people to acknowledge this tragedy that happened. And so,
yeah,
I mean, that was another part of this discussion that we're having.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Palestinians also feel strongly. Okay, so going back to what you said, Ray, the habits of mind, me and American, African Americans and indigenous people here. Yeah, no, it's not an idea. It's not a feeling. It's more intellectual identification.
Mm.
But with Jews and Palestinians, I affective, bodily, I relate.
Wow.
I think it must be because they are from the same region, maybe. I mean, all of us were under the Ottoman rule at some point, at least some Jews. It might be that. It might be because it's just a conflict that's close to home. Or because growing up, I had these type of people around. Not a lot, but we did have Jewish people, friends, as well as Arab friends. Maybe that's why. But I am also a modern Middle East historian. So I came to this country and pursued a PhD in Middle East and Islamic studies and history. And in the United States, when you study the Middle East, modern Middle East, the main topic that you study is the Palestinian conflict, Israel-Palestinian conflict. So, and I was only 22. Now that I'm thinking back, like I was socialized. I grew up in this conflict intellectually in my most formative years. And my graduate friends, like American Jews studying this, my main advisor was an American Jew who studies Palestinians. My mentor was a Palestinian activist historian whom I respect greatly, right? And also I was in New York City on top of it. So maybe because of all these reasons, when October 7th happened, my first of all, I didn't understand the scale of the first night or the second one even. Not everything was clear to me. But when I understood the scale, I felt very sad and angry. And most importantly, not for the region or it's bad for the Middle East, what's going to happen to Turkey. It's always that way for me also. Like, what's the implication for Turkey? My parents are in Turkey. My brother is in Turkey. Is still home to me, despite whatever I said previously, right? And also, Armenia is also there, next to Iran, Republic of Armenia, which I'm not from, but I have affinity. Like, I love that place. I go there every summer. So whatever happens in that conflict has implications for me otherwise. But basically, that post-trauma thing happened to me. It's very weird because historically, I am pro-Palestinian historically, and now I am pro-Palestinian. Palestinians, this is very clear to me, are the main wronged group here, despite all the mistakes that they did. Even after the Hamas attack, given the response, I think Israel is wrong. Has been wrong for so many reasons historically, right? Israeli state many times also behaves like the Turkish state. That's another thing in terms of how it relates to its own Palestinian citizens inside Israel with Israeli citizenship, right? So I have always also identified, I teach this. I teach a course called Minorities and Majorities in the Middle East, right? And we go through different cases, Palestinians in Israel, in terms of their relationship with the Israeli state, Armenians into Copts, indigenous group, for instance, Copts in Egypt, Egyptian Christian group, and its relationship with the Muslim state, right? These are my paradigmatic examples. But October 7 hit me differently because of its pogrom nature, I think. I responded as if I was very Jewish, let's say, or like pro-Jewish, or like, even though I knew that this was going to happen, so many of us, obviously, following this conflict, people have a tendency to resist. I understood why Israel immediately attacked, even though strategically or maybe tactically it wasn't right. I could see the vengeance, which is very difficult. And if anything resembling an existential threat happens, and now totally triggering the previous rounds of pogroms, but now happening in their own sovereign state, I would totally support the war at that moment. Now I don't support the war. I think it went way too long, many mistakes. But I remember, to be honest, yeah, despite myself, I was like, there needs to be a real response.
It's rare to say to be able to identify in that visceral way with each of the two parties to this conflict, which I think it's been a challenge for, it's a challenge for everyone. It's a challenge for me,
yes.
A challenge for many to be able to identify that strongly with either side.
Can I also add something?
Okay.
But also I understand the Hamas terrorists. Like, I also understand why you become a terrorist. Wow. Like, if the right conditions are met, I would become a terrorist. And we know this historically, right? Like, as a genocide scholar, this is one of the one-on-one of what we say, right? Like, also sociologists, construction, like, when the right conditions are met, people become evil. They can become evil. There are exceptions, but doesn't mean, of course, that I'm justifying it. I mean, needless to say, but it really also, I think I pushed back even immediately. While I was understanding the Jewish psyche of protection and a, like, counterattack, I also, even when in the very first day, the dehumanization language that the leadership used in Israel, genocidal language really that the leadership immediately used, I was disattached from that. And the refusal to understand why they would do it is a very dangerous one. I mean, talking about this Hamas as barbarians, for instance, like, it's very interesting for me. People do barbarian things, but does it make them barbarians? Like, when Turks did monstrous things, are they monsters themselves? And, like, when you try to understand the Turkish psyche, are you rationalizing it? And in this case also, I was very upset that even inside, I mean, we can start talking about at some point also the campus environment.
Yeah.
Maybe it was too early after October 7th, but there was a refusal to try to come to terms with the historical reasons that this happened.
To listen to you, and to have you first draw the distinction between, you know, your intellectual identification and your emotional identification, to hear you be so intellectual about a place where you have these strong emotional ties, it's amazing in my opinion. I don't know if that's the appropriate language to use, but it's just, it's impressive to hear someone who can be so thoughtful about things that are so emotionally close to them. That's
I'm still struggling as we speak. Thank you.
I can imagine it. I can imagine it.
I was just going to say what you were seeing on campus in terms of different communities and the challenge of providing support for people who had a natural affinity to one side or the other. The question is, like, to the extent that you thought that the Hamas attack was understandable, even though you weren't justifying it, in fact, you identified in the moment with Israelis, why is it that it was understandable given the context?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Because historically, despite the ties that Jews have to that land, like that they used to be indigenous to that land, what is now Israel and Palestine. So from the most zoomed out version of this, this is how I see it. Palestinians are a group who lived in their own land, not creating problems necessarily for Jews, for sure, before the mass Jewish arrival to the land. The same place is promised by the British, but to multiple groups. The British managed to establish a kind of a colony for themselves in Palestine during the interwar years, what we call British Palestine. And they basically mismanaged this difference between Jews who have been coming to this land from 1890s on, to settle, to coexist, to have a place of their own. While Palestinians are increasingly feeling threatened, they see that these outsiders are settling. There has always been Jews in this land. I mean, even in between centuries, obviously indigenous native Jews, we call them, who had Ottoman citizenship. They also, some Ashkenazi Jews also came. Anyways, but the historical arc of this story is that one side, in this case the Jewish side, who is wronged by another party, Nazis in Europe, many European countries who collaborate with the Nazis, other their own Jews, try to exterminate them, huge massive catastrophe, which then has its own unique consequences in this place called then British Palestine. The gist of the story is that this outsider group comes. Okay, outsider, I'm saying again, with all recognition that they have ties with this land. It's important to them. They could have coexistence, but it didn't happen. They come and they push whoever is then indigenous at that moment to the side, and they ethnically cleanse that territory and create refugees in other places. And then there are multiple post-Israeli establishment attempts to kind of find a way of living together. Regarding the most immediate previous context, what's happening in the occupied zones is something that we need to take into account, as well as the fact that Israeli government, together with Arab states, they were going to sign the Abrahamic records. Like, other Arab countries were almost going to be okay. They were like, Israel was almost going to get away.
You're talking in the lead up to October 7th now. In your mind, that's like, you know, key context for understanding why Palestinian national movements would want not to be sidelined and to assert national rights.
Yeah, but these are all short-sighted. Like when I say...
Yeah, you're understanding, not justifying.
Yeah, if I was a political scientist, that would be the explanation. I mean, in general, the whole long history makes us understand why a group who is living, Palestinians in this case, who were just being Palestinians, like even when the anti-Christian or anti-Jewish ethnic violence happened in the Ottoman Empire, first of all, in the Ottoman Empire, Jews, Christians, and Muslims lived more or less peacefully until 1860s. Okay, so there's nothing intrinsic about these religions or groups that they would have to kill each other. That's one. Two, Palestinians didn't do anything to Jews, period, before Jews did something to them. I think this is very important to understand. They were just living in this place, but outside conditions turned out to be such way that an outsider group came and claimed their country and eventually kind of conquered it. If I was a Palestinian, I wouldn't want to... Like, if I was a Palestinian, I would resist. I would totally reject leaving my home as much, especially if you know that you're there next door after Nakba. You have your key to your home, which you know now is even Mizrahim or Ashkenazi Jewish person is occupying. Like, why would I ever be okay with it? And especially, why would I ever be okay with it if different types of peaceful negotiations never worked fine?
Yeah.
Even when my side, let's say my Palestinian representative, it can be PLO, it can be Hamas, made mistakes. Even I see that my group many times made stupid mistakes, I would still not give up.
I think what I admire, and I think this echoes what Ray was saying before, is your ability to step inside the heads and the bodies of people, you know, on each side of this conflict. One thing I would say is, tell me if you think this is correct, at least your read of, you know, you were saying that Jewish national movements, right? Echoing something you said before, and the Jewish national imagination anyway, both reflected in and reinforced by Zionist, use the word mythology, right? In other words, the story it tells itself to itself. Is that, yes, Palestinians, you know, were indigenous, but they're also the reflection of a history of colonization, right? First by Roman and Byzantine, and then Muslim conquest, right? And Muslim Arab conquest in this case, and then Ottoman, right? Not to say that's the only frame at all. It's to say that's in the imaginary, and that's, you step inside of, to understand the conflict from each perspective makes sense.
Yes.
Right? And how they would react.
Yes.
Right?
But this is when I disagree with that imagery. And I find it to be literally useless and dangerous because it also sets the future wrong. For Armenians, let me start from there. There are different versions of this that I hear, right? Like, so many Armenians, some of them my relatives to this day, live with this dream that one day they will have their Armenia back from the Turks. And the example is, see how Israel did it. But it's just like, this will bring more war. Other people's displacement, first of all, it's not possible. We don't have the right demographics or the right people in power, such as the United States. Like, this is a dream that it's okay to sustain in our songs and folklore in general, as many diaspora countries do, but many also there are people taking it as their main point of nationalism, Armenian nationalism. And it's also, to be honest, it's one of the reasons why Turkey and Armenia don't have good ties right now, because some of these ultra-nationalists from time to time will bring it up.
You mean the Republic of Armenia now, right?
In Armenia, yes, because it will it means that we want part of Turkey as ours back, yep. Right? Like, politically also, it's not wise. But also now Palestinians who are these wronged Palestinians, let's say, I have met with these students who have, let's say, either Palestinian descent, or they might be Palestinians or Palestinian-American third generation, fourth generation, but they will think that they should go back to their land and Israel should be unmade because it's their land, right? Like, they are the conquerors, colonizers who came later. And my job as a teacher is to explain how it would, create more cycle of violence. And therefore, we have to find a way of, this is the basic formula that humanity has failed thus far, coexist with difference, despite historical dark moments. So when I first came to the United States, going back to that, I learned about this thing called affirmative action, which we don't have anymore. But to me, it was dizzying for me to understand how historically conscious of a policy it is. Like, there is so much recognition, acknowledgement that the past matters, therefore we need to do something in the future to possibly restore it even a little bit, and then we will accept this. In an ideal world, I would want the past to matter to the present, but not determine it.
You know, we were struck by in our earlier conversation about your ability to identify with each side of this conflict. And you had said that one of the main effects that, you know, the way that the crisis after October 7th affected you was that it led to a stronger identification with MIT, with the university. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, relates a bit to what we talked about in episode 3, Ray and I did, about the promise and also the challenge of universities as a place to forge relationships and to support identities, maybe sometimes happening in the background, but then with some challenges when there's thrust to the foreground. What did you have in mind when you said that you felt more strongly connected or identified with MIT?
Can I add a little bit more? It was after, Lerner, you said that you identified with Palestinians and you also identified with Jews. And we asked you which identity was most salient during the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because we were simple-minded and thought you would be reduced.
That was you, Ray. Yeah. You're simple-minded.
I'm simple-minded, thinking, well, let's see when she's reduced, which one it is. And you said, MIT professor.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until you asked that to me. I'm still trying to understand this, and I didn't talk to anyone about this other than you guys, really. I felt like, on the one hand, irresponsibility to MIT, because I'm one of the very few people who study the Middle East. Like, we have professors, faculty, staff who are from the Middle East or have ties, Jewish, Arab, Middle Eastern, all that, but they don't teach it. I started feeling like I matter to MIT more because I am a historian and this is MIT, right? We know that social sciences and humanities are a smaller portion of MIT. And it, in general, I don't know, my sense of importance for the institute significantly increased. And it gave me this responsibility to be more vocal. And I embraced it rather. Like, I didn't feel like I should not make myself part of what is going on. Like, it's good and it's my responsibility. And then also, the other thing is that I was very surprised. Like, October 7, 8, 9 happened, or even until the lobby, November 7, the protest in the lobby. 2 days before November 7th, I think Harvard had already started their protest. A friend of mine asked, like, how it was doing, how MIT was doing in terms of, like, in relationship between students and faculty. And I was like, it's relatively calm, yeah, things are happening. But, like, I don't anticipate that we will just be stuck on this too much. it's MIT, our students are usually not that political in general. And I was like, yeah, unfortunately, this is the case. They don't care as much. Because why? Because
be careful what you wish for, Lerna.
I know. I am so conflicted about it. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Even now, I don't think it's a bad thing, though. So I'm the director of Women and Gender Studies. I organized these talks, Macmillan Stewart talks on women in the developing world, women in the Middle East mostly. I had Palestinian scholars coming and giving lectures in the past about gender issues mostly. I've never received this kind of pushback from students. I became more of an MIT professor because some of the programming that we did was under attack. So we had one programming about justice for Palestine students wanting to read a book, a Palestinian activist's book. And us, WGS, we sponsored this IAP book club.
This is IAP, for people who don't know, MIT is the, in January, there's
Independent Activity
Spirit. Independent
Activity Spirit. Yes.
It's the time when most students would be allowed to take a break that MIT decides we should give them.
Yeah.
And ourselves too, right? Yes, why not? So anyways, there was response from so many like Jewish students and some staff as well that I was not expecting. So I had to respond to these situations. Then we had an event about the sexual violence of the October 7th attack with two Israeli legal scholars presenting their interpretation of them. We had IDHR complaints and like response from the more Palestinian pro-Arab. So both, like, we did two different events. And we had the other group accusing us of not validating their concerns or erasing whatever happened. Like, this mutually exclusive logic was very apparent to me. And then what happened, and I think the reason why my MIT identity became very important to me, was I understood that MIT needs me. Like, I come from Turkey. I know how people fail to coexist or just read everything as zero-sum game and how dysfunctional this is. And it increasingly, MIT started feeling like home. Like, it reminded me of home, Turkey.
This is actually really consistent, Ezra, with our observation that we saw the university as a place that brought people with different backgrounds together, and that wasn't happening in the fall. It was divisive. That people were more divided than the university wasn't fulfilling its promise. In a sense, that's what I heard Lerna saying.
Yes, but it should. I mean, it's okay. Something very big happened out there in the world. That it has this relevance for different group inside the MIT and that they care for it is a good thing for me. Right?
I agree. So we should be able to disagree, but also somehow coalesce. And we haven't gotten to the coalesce yet.
Exactly. And I thought not being a Jew or Arab, but still being from the Middle East and being an expert of this region, generally speaking, and teaching this, and also being an Armenian from Turkey who grew up in a denialist place with best friends that were Turkish, right? Like, I can see how you can compartmentalize at different times, or like that things might not be ideal and perfect at all times, but it doesn't mean that we are against each other. Like, the multiplicity of views, all faculty here, and most students hopefully believe in one thing, that it's scientific, like that we pursue facts. Facts are important. We know about the world by doing research and collecting data and turning it to knowledge and disseminating at different venues as much as possible. Like, we have a mission. And that mission, as long as it's shared and as long as there is a minimal amount of trust that everyone here is smart, I hope they are smart, that can be worked out. I guess that's my take. We can work it out.
I mean, it sounds to me like your identification with MIT is both, on the one hand, the sense like, oh my God, it reminds me of home, and people basically having this kind of like validation for me means invalidation for you. But then it's also identification with the promise of what the university can be.
Yes.
It's the same promise that like brought me and you know, Ray together and forge our relationship, as we were talking about in episode three. And then this is where I think why, you know, Ray and I, why we invited Lerna on is because we're so admiring of you, Lerna, of your identifying with the task, the leadership task of somehow taking what you've learned uniquely, I think, in a lot of ways, and want to apply it to like getting us back to what we're supposed to be great at, right? And what we can achieve together,
Yeah, and that's what I also appreciate, right? Like this conflict forced us to build new alliances and be in different spaces and be heard by people that we wouldn't otherwise hear. It built community. I think even our famous, infamous faculty meetings, I was thinking about them, like these big, huge faculty meetings where we had very passionate conversations, disagreements, they are all community building. If you think about them, like we kind of enjoy them. Like, yes, it's sad, but at the same time, it means that we care. When we learned that we received funding from Jeffrey Epstein, MIT faculty, we kept our administration accountable.
There is a little difference between Epstein and the other events, and it's that with Epstein, it was us versus the administration. Soon it was different parts of the community, right? Even with Dorian Abbott, even with Abbott, it was there were different parts of the university who were making appeals to the administration, asking the administration to pick a side.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's been the theme from that point forward, where the, now it's competing interest in our community asking the administration to choose. And I think that's what makes this so hard.
Most people were, of course, anti-Epstein. So it was an easier moment. It was us versus the administration and what they will do. When we talked about these like long, big faculty meetings about freedom of expression, what is canceling, what's deplatforming, I think they prepared us for the post-October 7th moment.
Well, we have more preparing to do. But in each case, there were, you know, it led to mobilization of a lot of effort, faculty, staff, and students to try to close the gap between what we all kind of hoped for from our university and what was revealed by the episode as being a challenge.
Related to what we were talking about in the last episode around the lunches for the different identity groups, what it provided, I hadn't thought about the faculty meetings in the same way, but they have, this has provided an opportunity for community. It's, and so let's not only think in terms of what the challenges have been, but also think in terms of what this has provided an opportunity for us to do. And that's to build relationships with people where those relationships normally wouldn't have existed. We'd have been too busy doing our research to build them.
Right. And those relations are forged, and those relationships are all in one way or another about, you know, who we want to be together, right? What we want to build together.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I remember in one of the faculty meetings earlier after October 7th, I remember leaving the meeting and thinking that, I don't know, maybe this is weird, but I remember distinctly thinking that, wow, everyone loves MIT. Like everyone who was in that room, so many of us, even like we didn't speak, but you must care really, because also so many people probably also don't care about the region as well. They were there, right? It is kind of a unique, it's a good place. We should, we should make it better, and it's a process.
Lerna, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
I want to join Ray in thanking
you.
I can't imagine a better way for you to give to our community and to this conversation that we've been having for us to be able to build on it. Really just amazing. Really appreciate it.
We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So Ray, I think that some listeners might have had a little trouble following the last bit of our discussion with Lerna. So it became a little inside baseball there.
There's a lot of people who aren't intimately aware of the dynamics happening at MIT.
Right.
And I think you're referring to our discussion of Epstein and Abbott.
Yeah, two buzzwords that mean a lot to, especially the faculty who've been here as long as a decade or more at MIT. But not even everyone on campus knows what those words refer to, unless you've been paying close attention.
And I don't think anyone outside of MIT should have been paying that kind of attention to MIT. But when you hear faculty members at MIT say Epstein, the Epstein controversy
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Jeffrey Epstein here. Yeah.
Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when you hear Epstein, that's what people are referring to. And when you hear Abbott.
Yeah, people are referring to a professor at University of Chicago, Dorian Abbott. And a couple of years later, I think this is 21 that this happened.
And he's understood by some to be a critic of affirmative action. I'm not sure I would call him a critic. I would just say that he had a different solution to affirmative action programs. One of them highlighted the importance of improving the educational systems in inner city schools. And the other piece of his solution was in legacy programs.
And there's a lot to say there about that, but also in the perception, how he was perceived on campus, especially at that time, and also what it led to, which was the cancellation of a speech, a public address.
Exactly.
Right. And that led to a major controversy on campus with lines drawn. And I think the point we were making there in the conversation with Lerna was a very specific point, which had to do with the nature of those dynamics. I think, Ray, I don't know if you agree with me, that the dynamics were particularly different between Epstein and what happened on campus last fall, where there was much more consensus about the meaning of the Epstein affair and what needed to be cleaned up
exactly.
at MIT as a result of that, then there was certainly not a high degree of consensus last year.
I think the divisions that we currently see on campus, you know, started to emerge around Abbott. I think Epstein was easy for the community. Right? It was a sex offender. The community could mobilize and ask the administration or demand from the administration that something be done. Right? Abbott was a little different. Abbott was two different parts of the community asking the administration to do different things. And they were asking the administration to do something different around the issue of free speech.
Right. Yeah. And it did lead to, I think, a very clear direction, like new policies that were then implemented, but it then had after effects, I think, that are lingering questions about free speech that then showed up in a couple different ways, I think, since then, and that I think have a lot of parallels and echoes in other campuses, and then certainly showed up again last year, and then I think it became challenging, and hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this in a later episode, but we're definitely running out of time for this episode, Ray.
We're definitely running out of time, and it's around this issue. Is that one part of our community, they were concerned about, you know, the message, or at least their understanding or their perception of the message that Abbott would share. And they didn't think it was something that should be discussed on the MIT campus. And there were other side who were concerned that MIT would be on the record for canceling culture, so to speak. So those were the two sides. Fast forward.
Yeah.
And now those sides have switched.
Yeah, they're not exactly the same people.
And they're not exactly the same people.
But there's very good evidence. We can post this, be able to tease people for the future of depending on, let's say, right and left on American political spectrum, shifting of standards. Like basically it's sort of free speech for me, but not for thee.
I like that. That was very well put.
This has been a great lead-in to our next conversation. Which will be with our wonderful colleague in political science, Lily Tsai.
I'm Ray Reagans.
I'm Ezra Zuckerman-Sivan.
You've been listening to Outsider.
Insider.
A podcast from MIT.
Special thanks for this episode to our dear colleague and friend, Lerna Ekmancholu.
And as always, we're grateful to our producer, Lucy McCormick.
And executive producer Kate O'Sullivan.
With help from consulting producer Hamid Albadi.
And mixed by Hansdale Shee.